From KBOO in Portland, Oregon, this is Progressive Spirit. ProgressiveSpirit.net, I'm John Schuck. I have a prediction. My prediction is that my guest today will be seen by our descendants as the most important theologian of the latter 20th and early 21st centuries. He will go down in history, assuming there is a history, as the most important prophet not heard in his own time. He's the author of over 25 books on theology and philosophy and another dozen on 9/11. He's the world's premier scholar regarding the search for the truth behind 9/11. His books on 9/11 have been ignored by the media, not because of their scholarship, but because Americans cannot handle the implications. Now he's turned his critical eye toward the CO2 crisis. On the phone with me from Santa Barbara, California, is David Ray Griffin to discuss his latest book, Unprecedented: Can Civilization Survive the CO2 Crisis? Welcome, Professor Griffin, to Progressive Spirit.
Thank you very much.
You know, I moved to Portland in January 2015. The first year, the locals told me that the weather isn't normally like this. It was first the hottest, and then it was the driest, and then in December, it was the wettest that the natives here remembered. So I guess we could say that extreme weather conditions in Portland were unprecedented. We've been experiencing unprecedented climate disruptions. On a scale of 1 to 10, with 10 being absolutely critical, how serious is global warming?
Well, unfortunately, it's a 10 now as well as the future. So things are not making life impossible now. But if we continue on without radical changes, life will soon be very unpleasant and then eventually impossible.
How certain are scientists about global warming and climate change?
Oh, about 99.9%.
And, of course, that's very different from what the media seems to indicate.
Yeah. The media are trying to sell us things, not tell us truth. I think in some ways the most important chapter in my book was on the media, and certainly when I get to the final chapter on what can be done, in which we need a very extreme change. Why the media, I argue, is the most important thing. Of course, the president, the Congress, but without the media, there will be little, if no hope.
In the first part of your book, you write about unprecedented threats: extreme weather, heat waves, droughts, wildfires, storms, sea level rise, freshwater shortage, food shortage, climate refugees, climate wars, a chapter on each of those topics. Of these, can you give a few examples, a few word pictures to lay out the problem?
Poetry isn't my specialty, but we can at least get images where we can imagine what will be coming. For one thing, tornadoes are the things that frighten me the most, and now there are going to be ever more powerful tornadoes. They're going to occur more often. And they're going to start occurring in places where they have never been. So we're not going to have any cellars to get down into. Hurricanes will continue getting worse. So at some time, people, assuming there will be people at the time, will look back to thinking, Katrina and Sandy, what was the big deal? They seem pretty mild. Rainstorms will increasingly flood our roads and our crops. Droughts in some places will be lasting years or even permanently here in the Southwest. And billions of people in Asia and South America, places in the world that are depending upon glaciers, almost almost 100% dependent upon glaciers for drinking water and agricultural water. The glaciers are melting, with frightening speed, and so there will be literally billions of people without clean drinking water, without capability to grow crops.
Now, can we talk a timeline for this? I mean, when we hear things like the sea level will be rising a foot or whatever by the year 2100, it seems a little abstract and distant. When do you see these kinds of things really impacting us? Like my nephew, when he's my age, the year will be about 2060. What will he look like if we carry on as business as usual?
Yeah, well, our feet may be wet. When I wrote my book, I quoted a couple of guys there wrote a big book about the raising of the tide. They said, get ready for 7 feet, meaning by the end of the century. And most people thought, oh, come on, that's ridiculous. The real experts are telling us it may go up 12 inches or maybe a foot, at most 2 feet, or you know, the real extreme guys will say 3 feet. Well, now there's a growing consensus that 7 is too modest, that it's more looking like 10 feet. Well, when you take just cut that in half then, that wouldn't be exact, of course, but just say roughly. Let's say 5 feet by the time your nephew is your present age. We're going to have much less land. We will have moved inland from the oceans. You know, cities like Boston and New York, obviously Miami, parts of San Francisco or more, and Los Angeles in particular, Seattle, Tacoma, they will lose a lot of their buildings. I mean, they'll be underwater. It'd be unlivable. Be no business there. So you get some image that 4 or 5 feet. Can make a drastic, very drastic changes.
And of course, the effects of that would be, economic collapse, wouldn't it? I mean, with major cities and people having to move.
It'll certainly not be helpful, yeah. And then even, that's what we in the rich world will suffer. There'll be some places that can block themselves off, sort of like the Netherlands, but a lot of places going down the East Coast would be very hard to block that whole area off. But with a lot of people, it'll be much more serious than that. So already in Bangladesh, you have tens of thousands of people needing to move. And India then is doing everything they can to block them. So we're having some immigration problems in Europe now because of the wars in Syria and Iraq and Libya and other places. Well, the immigration problem, when we get an increase in 3 or so feet, will make that look like the good old days when there really were not serious immigration problems. And so people will be, blocked out. They'll be not only fenced out, they'll be shot if they. So, I mean, it'll get pretty ugly.
If you're just joining us on Progressive Spirit, my guest is David Ray Griffin, author of Unprecedented: Can Civilization Survive the CO2 Crisis? And these are conditions that aren't a fantasy. This isn't an apocalyptic novel. This is what the science would show us are the effects if we continue to pump CO2 into the atmosphere at the rate we're doing now.
That's right. In my book, I rely primarily on James Hansen, who is generally considered the overall expert on these matters. And it was a recent paper by him that said 10 to 11 feet by the end of the century would be probable.
Now, there are forces that aren't ignorant necessarily about this. I wonder what the president really thinks, but actually deceptive in regards to manufacturing doubt regarding climate change. How is the public manipulated? We talked earlier a little bit about the media, but how is the public manipulated and by whom?
Yeah, of course, I have a whole chapter on that. The way the fossil fuel companies have, and especially ExxonMobil, have paid millions of dollars for people all around the world to be denying climate change. You write an article in the paper talking about the likelihood of increase of several feet, and you get a number of rebuttals. So when you're looking on the internet, there are more people denying that there's going to be any serious ocean rise than those affirming it. They have been doing this now for at least two full decades, between two and three decades. Now, just today, there was a new story, a new report coming out that showed that ExxonMobil knew the full truth about this much earlier. At the very end of the 60s and the 1970s, we had some earlier reports that were pretty sensationalist that got a lot of attention, saying that ExxonMobil knew this in the 1980s and covered it up. So their scientists were very good scientists. They reported the facts and they said, you know, this is going to cause a great number of terrible effects. So we're going to have to do something with fossil fuels if we're going to have a functioning civilization in another century or so. And at some point then, the front office said, no more of that talk. And they tried to disappear all those reports and started then putting out these climate denial groups all around the world, particularly in the United States. So this is, you know, you ask about, you had asked me in a note prior to our discussion about evil and my views on philosophy and theology. Well, this is about as evil as you get. In order to have immediate profits over the next two or three decades, you're willing to risk the destruction of civilization.
You are a theology and philosophy is your career. A Wikipedia article I read about you lists 25 of your books on those topics, another dozen or so on 9/11. In fact, your book, Christian Faith and the Truth Behind 9/11, A Call to Reflection and Action, was the book that changed my outlook on 9/11. When the Presbyterian Publishing House stopped selling it, I realized that you were an author that needed to be read. Now Unprecedented, which one reviewer, Richard Falk of Princeton, said, if you read only one book on climate change, make it be unprecedented. So is there a connection between the books you've written on theology as well as 9/11 and this latest Unprecedented?
Yeah, there's quite a connection. Those various writings, the ones in philosophy of religion, and theology, they're what you might call implicitly save the world books. The ones on 9/11 and climate change are explicitly Save the World books. So those are rather obvious, but the ways that those other books are implicitly about this is about a worldview. I've argued that the world is meaningful, that it is a religious universe, that religious experience is real, that moral obligation, moral norms are real. And I've spent a lot of time pointing out that the reality of a divine being and moral norms is not contradicted by the problem of evil. So I wrote two full-length books on that and you know, lots of articles. And then I've written a book on freedom, on the mind-body problem, showing how, although most philosophers have argued that freedom does not exist, it's impossible. I point out a way to understand that indeed it is, and it's something we all necessarily presuppose in practice. Even these philosophers who deny freedom say, well, we can't help living without presupposing freedom. And finally, the more freedom that creatures have, the greater the danger. And obviously on our planet, we have the greatest amount of freedom. And likewise, we are the greatest danger to the planet.
You're listening to Progressive Spirit. My guest is David Ray Griffin. He's the author of Unprecedented: Can Civilization Survive the CO2 Crisis? When we talk about God or something like that as a supernatural being who's protecting the earth and all of that kind of stuff, that is such a popular type of theology that ends up being destructive for our outlook.
Yeah, in the United States in particular, the two greatest problems with recognizing the reality of climate change and its dangers is, on the one hand, the fossil fuel agencies and organizations which have denied it. So even ExxonMobil, who've admitted now that they lied, they still carry on with their lying. And then the other major problem is the belief in an omnipotent deity. So you have many people, including people in the U.S. Senate and House of Representatives, explicitly denying that there's any problem with climate change, because God's in charge, as is Senator Inhofe from Oklahoma said, you know, God's still up there. So we don't need to worry about this, because God would not let climate change destroy us, unless, of course, God wants to do so. So it's not a problem we need to deal with.
Yeah, well, I mean, and the more extreme views of that are rather apocalyptic, that, you know, bring on the problems so Christ will return.
Yeah, that's, like you said, even more extreme. And so so you've got different degrees of climate denial based upon theological ideas, and I don't hesitate to say completely false theological ideas.
Well, one thing you write about is the moral challenge we face to move away from fossil fuels as we moved away from slavery, an abolitionist movement, so to speak. So what is the slave, or who is the slave owner in this respect, and are we not all culpable if we use fossil fuels?
Yes, we are all culpable to one degree or another, because to some extent, we were blameless because until about 40 years ago, we didn't know, and until about 20 to 30 years ago, the general public didn't even know. But now we do know, or at least If you don't know, you're deliberately, being ignorant where you should know. On the slavery, yeah. See, at one time, the fossil fuels came in. It made it possible to get rid of slavery because we had these now devices and all sorts of things that allowed people to still live comfortable lives without having slaves. In other words, the rich and the upper middle class people. And so it helped the abolition movement, the fact that the fossil fuels were there, so that we did have these labor-saving devices. Now, the new slavery is all of these devices that are dependent upon fossil fuels. So, yes, but just as the fossil fuels allowed us to get out of slavery without terrible changes, likewise, we now have a way out, thanks to clean energy, that we can quit using fossil fuels, and we could quit rather quickly. Some people think that if we went full out with, World War II type mobilization, we could overcome at least 90% of the fossil fuel usage within 20 years. But obviously there is very little movement in that direction thus far. And certainly you don't get discussions about this on the evening news. You know, they might have taken a few seconds away from talking about Donald Trump to talk about the future of the planet.
David Ray Griffith is my guest. He's the author of Unprecedented: Can Civilization Survive the CO2 Crisis? You have a whole chapter that is thorough regarding clean energy. You even write about electric airplanes. I wonder if our society has been built, though, on fossil fuels, evolved from that. Can it really transition to life as we know it or have known it on other forms of energy? Might we need a whole new way of living, perhaps even beyond automobiles and planes?
Yeah, we are now addicted, both personally and just in terms of the way our society and our cities are structured. For example, being in part of the not too far from Los Angeles, there is hardly any, very little public transportation, and so most people feel like they're necessitated to use automobiles. But now that we recognize the addiction, we now can see the addiction is killing us. In spite of what the fossil fuel industry says, there are now adequate alternatives. We could, as you say, live a different kind of life. Communities could be restructured such that you could get most places by walking or using bikes or trains. Reduce plane travel could be reduced by, say, 95%, still allow us to get around the world when it was necessary. We could stay at home a lot more thanks to the internet and electronics and so on. So, yeah, we could have a very different kind of life, and we could have, a much better kind of life. People out here sometimes spend 4 hours every day commuting to and from work.
In each of your chapters, you have a plan A, a plan B, and a plan C. A plan A is if we just kind of continue on as we're doing. A plan C is wait 10, 20 years or so till it gets really worse, then perhaps mobilize. And plan B is a mobilization immediately. So we could write a lot about, how we need to do it, but getting that motivation going seems to be the huge problem.
Yeah, and this gets into what theologians call original sin. That is, human beings have a rather deep-seated tendency to be concerned about their own welfare and that of their family and their rather immediate community. So the idea that we should make any significant changes and certainly any sacrifices in order to help people in future generations, that's, you know, not within the worldview of most people these days, at least in the United States and much of the Western world. Native Americans, of course, at least some of them, had this tradition that every decision you make, you should make in terms of the next seven generations. So don't do anything that's going to ruin life for people in the next seven generations. We have people who aren't even worried about, evidently, in terms of their behavior, about their own children and certainly not about their grandchildren. That more important is to have my own comfort and pleasure right now.
David Rigg Griffin has been my guest on Progressive Spirit. His book is Unprecedented: Can Civilization Survive the CO2 Crisis? Professor Griffin, thank you for this book. Thank you for being with me today.
Thank you, John.
You've been listening to Progressive Spirit. For more information about the show and links to podcasts, go to progressivespirit.net. From KBOO in Portland, Oregon, I'm John Schuck. Be well.